Chapter 55. Pharaoh. After he'd left Amanda's building, Pharaoh drove back to the precinct. The Thanksgiving Day shift varied. Sometimes it was busy, usually domestics. Sometimes it was quiet. Today was one of the quiet days. He had peace to think. He called the hospital, and they said Quinn hadn't improved. The bleeding and trauma to the chest had caused a cardiac arrest. He was deteriorating and remained unconscious. Pharaoh glanced at the stack of files below his desk, all unsolved. Most cops kept their working files in the cabinets. When a case could not be closed, after a while, it got iced. It was supposed to be put away, marked as unsolved, and relegated to a box in the basement. If new information came up, the case could be thawed and reopened. Few, if any, were ever resurrected. The stack below his desk all should have had a layer of ice on them. Instead, they had been saved from the freezing basement and allowed to gather a little dust. Pharaoh could not bear to put them away. He had few unsolved for a veteran cop. Part of it was luck, maybe, but part of it was due to his stubbornness and tenacity. At the top of that pile was a manila folder, actually three manila folders, held together with purple string. At some stage, probably more than 5 years ago, some joker in the homicide division had drawn a pair of blue eyes on top of the file in magic marker. Those eyes stared back at Pharaoh from below the desk. Mr. Blue Eyes had not resurfaced since the attack on Ruth Gelman more than 10 years ago. Pharaoh often wondered what had happened to him. Maybe he was in prison for something else. Maybe he was dead. Pharaoh couldn't say what had happened to make the killings stop. The one possibility he feared the most was this. What if the killings hadn't stopped, and he was simply missing those victims, not connecting them to the first two murders and the failed attack on Ruth Gelman? He knew Mr. Blue Eyes had been interrupted during Ruth's attack. He'd heard sirens and fled the scene before finishing off the victim. Maybe he was too scared to do it again. Or maybe he stepped up his game afterwards and took pains to better hide his victims, change his MO. That's why Pharaoh put out a standing order to all dispatchers. Any homicide or attempted homicides involving home invasion in the Manhattan area, Hernandez and Pharaoh got a courtesy call. Sometimes it was clear before they even went to the scene that it was unconnected. Sometimes they got an incorrect call, like Quinn, where the victim was male. Sometimes it wasn't exactly clear whether it was related to Mr. Blue Eyes or not. Out of the calls he and Hernandez had attended in the last 10 years, maybe two could have been Mr. Blue Eyes, maybe none. Hernandez always complained about it, thought it was a waste of time, and an opportunity for Pharaoh to pick up more cases that they didn't need. He knew that he took those additional cases because he could close them, and in doing so, he could get some release. Some relief from the cold files that hung around his feet like ghosts. He stared at the blue eyes on the cover for a while, shook his head. He had another old case gathering heat, and he somehow wanted that to start warming up Mr. Blue Eyes, melting that magic marker on the file. He sighed, rubbed his temples, and got back to work. He spent the shift with his head buried in reports, statements, and then went home. He ate a turkey club in honor of Thanksgiving, watched a game on TV, then went to bed. Back pain woke Pharaoh the next morning, just after 4 a.m. Slowly, he turned over on his side, clenching his teeth with the pain. His bladder was calling him to the bathroom, but it would have to wait. With great effort, Pharaoh swung his body over to lie on his front. He panted rhythmically, filling his lungs before his next move. Breathing hurt, lying down hurt, everything hurt. Swinging his feet clear of the bed, his toes found the floor. Then he began pushing himself up into a standing position. Straightening up was a slow process, one he had to do in stages. 4 minutes later, he stood by the bed, the pain manageable. It was two steps to the nightstand and his glass of water and a bottle of OxyContin. Those steps were halting and slow, as if each one brought a baseball bat across his spine. He drank first to wet his throat, then again to swallow the pills. They would take a half hour to kick in, about as long as it would take him to get downstairs and make coffee. They would take the edge off the pain, and any dulling effect on his mind would have worn off by the time his shift began. He got into the shower, turned the water up as hot as he could bear, and let the jet pound his back. It helped loosen him up. After that, he dressed in a clean blue shirt and navy suit. He had a device he'd ordered from one of the shopping channels to help him put on his socks. His shoes were slip-ons, and he was able to work his feet into them. He unplugged his phone from the charger and put it in his pants pocket. Leaving the suit jacket and tie in the hallway at the bottom of the stairs, he went into the kitchen and started to grind coffee beans. He'd just hit the plunger on the French press when his cell phone rang. The time on the phone read 5:50 a.m. Never a good sign when the phone rings at that time of the morning.
"Did I wake you?" said Hernandez.
"Nope, I was already awake and doing my hot yoga exercises."
"I can't picture you in spandex. This is a good thing for me."
"You're up early. Did you have a nice holiday yesterday?"
"It was boring as hell. I watched the parade on TV, ate dry turkey, and harassed the forensic techs."
"They find anything on Quinn's computer yet?"
"They're still looking. Apparently, he has state-of-the-art security."
"His tax returns just say he's a consultant. Is he some kind of security specialist?"
"Could be, but we'll find out soon enough. I did get something back on the cell phone found in the tool shed, though," said Hernandez.
"Something good, I hope."
"It's a burner, disposable. The batch number was traced to an order from a small-time store in Midtown. I got the owner yesterday at home. She's got good records. She'd ordered 5 of those photos. She's got 3 in stock. 2 were bought last week."
"She remember the buyers?"
"We're not that lucky. But she did tell us that it wasn't 2 buyers, it was 1. Both phones are recorded as sold in a single transaction." "Are you coming in today?" asked Hernandez.
"I'm going to try to find Amanda. I didn't get her on Thanksgiving Eve. And when I went by her apartment yesterday morning, there was no answer. I left her a voicemail, asked her to come in."
"And you think she'll do that?"
"I think so. I didn't tell her what it was about. Not exactly the kind of thing you can lay out in a voicemail. She'll come in. She trusts me."
"How do you think she'll react?"
"If I know Amanda, she'll put up a fight. Look, just keep on those computer techs. Quinn is a blank, and I think that laptop has some answers. Maybe even a motive."
He ended the call, pushed the plunger all the way down on his coffee, and poured himself a cup. It wasn't like Amanda not to return his calls, but it was Thanksgiving yesterday. Holidays were especially tough for the bereaved. He tried calling again, but the call went straight to voicemail. He didn't leave another message. He'd been around lost and broken people for too long. He knew it paid to be sensitive, and he knew Amanda was in trouble. In the early days after Luis and Jess's funeral, Amanda would call Farrow every other day. When there was a development or anything of note to report, he called her straight away. Farrow had never married, didn't have kids. He'd realized early that the job and a fulfilled family life were not easy bedfellows. Some cops could do it. They could come home on time, switch that shit off, and be with their kids, their wives, or husbands. It was not something Farrow could do. The job demanded too much. It consumed his every waking moment, even his dreams. He sometimes saw their faces in the dark, the ones whom he'd found, the dead victims, crying out to him in the night, reaching for him. Not to hurt him. They always wanted to touch his hand, hold on to him. And so he held on to them, kept them close. He owed the dead a debt, and he saw to it that it got paid. He'd been the second cop on the scene when Jess's body had been found. That was one night he would never forget. A little girl in a dumpster surrounded by black garbage bags. Her small hands, her toes, cold, dead, unnatural. That image took something from him that day and replaced it with a fire. Something very human inside Farrow was brought alive. It burned in him. It flamed whenever he sat across the table from Wallace Crone in the precinct interview room. He knew the man had killed that little girl. He was certain of it. And while Crone had constantly denied it, in his black eyes,
Pharaoh saw the truth. He'd seen not only that Crone had killed the girl, but that he'd enjoyed it. He would never forget that interview. Crone had been questioned by police on multiple occasions. This time it was no different. He sat in the interrogation room with this lawyer, who told him not to say anything. Of course, Crone was too narcissistic to take the advice to heart. He didn't answer all of their questions, but he didn't mind riling them up. "Where were you on the day Jess White was abducted?" asked Hernandez. He didn't answer. He just looked at the shoulder of his tailor-made suit and brushed some tiny speck of dust from it, then he smiled. "We have a man on security footage leading Jess away from the park, and that man looks a lot like you. That's why you're here." Crone merely shrugged, said,
"It wasn't me."
"Don't you care that a child was abducted, abused, and murdered?" asked Hernandez. It was an open question, appealing to the side of Crone's personality that thought of himself as a victim of the police. The answer he'd given to that question in that room that day still made Pharaoh's heart beat faster.
"When you say abused, you mean they had sex. That's not abuse. Some girls are more mature than you give them credit for. I treat them like the women they are. You know my history, my rap sheet. I like young girls, Officer Hernandez. I like to sleep with them. You wouldn't understand, but there's nothing wrong with that. They like it, I like it. I don't see a problem. I don't know this girl, but from what you've told me, it sure sounds like someone had a good time with her."
Hernandez had looked at Pharaoh then. They'd sat side by side. Her mouth was open.
"I knew you wouldn't understand. Society has created a false narrative. If you look at the Bible, this happened all the time," said Crone.
Neither of them could speak. Pharaoh gritted his teeth.
"You're pretty cute," said Crone, still staring at Hernandez. "But you're too old for me. Do you have any kids?"
The lawyer told him right then to keep quiet, and Crone leaned back in his seat, folded his arms, and put another smug grin on his face. To this day, months later, Pharaoh still wasn't sure how he or Hernandez were able to hold their nerve in that room and not reach over the table and strangle Crone to death. God knows he deserved it. As well as a debt owed to the dead, Pharaoh owed something to those left behind. Amanda had been hit harder than most, and Pharaoh had watched her heart break. And yet what pulled at him was that she never gave up. She kept fighting, even when it was hopeless. He'd spent many late nights sitting on her couch, listening to her talk about Jess and Luis and the life that they'd had and all the things that they would never have now. It was fuel for Pharaoh. The pain helped to keep him sharp, ready, on the edge. When the forensics team had called him and given him the news on their DNA results, he'd felt his heart trip out of rhythm. Amanda didn't deserve what was coming to her, and he needed to be there, in person, to hold her hand once again.